You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Let's begin with our motivation. So, as I was saying to the high school students that came today, it's so important that we have respect for each and every living being and see each being as worthwhile and as much as possible to free ourselves of attachment, anger, and apathy that causes us to favor some beings and discriminate against others and ignore a third group. So along this line, it's helpful to remember is that just as much as we want people to accept us and to feel favorable about us, then so too we should try to train our mind to accept others and to feel favorable towards them, to see their good qualities. So this is quite important in terms of our regular life, being happy on a day-to-day level. But it's absolutely necessary to accomplish the path to awakening. Because there's no such thing as a biased Buddha or a prejudiced Buddha. So instead of looking superficially at sentient beings, where we can surely discriminate a lot of different qualities, good and bad, likes and dislikes, let's try and look in everybody's heart and see that they're all wanting happiness and not suffering. And that we can play a role in helping them to have happiness and alleviating their misery. What a wonderful way to make our lives useful by doing this in whatever small or large ways we can. So listening to the Dharma teachings, trying to put them in practice, thinking about their meaning, living according to them, all of this is a way to benefit sentient beings, including ourselves. And so learning how to do this through listening to teachings is likewise something very good that we can do to benefit living beings. And so with that aspiration to benefit them, by listening to teachings, by transforming our mind, by freeing ourselves of our ignorance, anger, and attachment, by developing all of our good qualities and wisdom, with that kind of very far-sighted intention, then let's listen and discuss the Buddhist Dharma this evening. So we've been going through Nagarjuna's precious garland, a letter of advice to a king, and we've just completed the fourth of the five chapters last session, and you're probably hanging on the edge of your seat waiting to see what happens. Okay. Because Nagarjuna left us with a cliffhanger as as the last verse of the last chapter. So that verse, after spending 99 other verses helping the king learn how to establish royal policy and run the country, then on verse 400 he says to the king, "However, if you're unable to rule in accordance with the Dharma, because the world is opposed to Dharma, then for the sake of Dharma and glory, it makes sense for you to become a monastic." So now, will he do it or won't he do it? What's going to happen? Okay. So he doesn't tell us in that last chapter, and he doesn't actually tell us anywhere in the book what the king decides to do. But he does spend another 100 verses telling the king the practice of the bodhisattvas, which begins with here ordaining and the advice to him as an ordained person. So we don't really know. Did the king take the step? Did he decide to stay in the world with his palace and his jewels and his wives? You know? Or did somebody come along and pressure him one way or the other? Or did he decide to ordain and then he got cold feet? Because he didn't want to leave the palace and the family. Yeah? Or maybe he stayed with the palace and the family and got so fed up that he walked out another, you know. We don't know. So, but what is more important than what the king decides is what we decide to do in our lives. Because we can't control what the king decides. Yeah, we can only speak for ourselves and decide in our own lives what the best way to practice the Dharma. Okay. So, the chapter 5, the part 5, is called The Practices of the Bodhisattva. And the first section in this is Abandoning Afflictions and Cultivating Goodness. So here he's saying to the king, if you want to be able to engage in the Bodhisattva practices, which lead to full awakening, we need to reduce our afflictions and our bad behavior as much as possible. And in that light, it's very helpful to become a monastic, because when you take precepts, then you've already thought quite clearly about your behavior, what you want to do, what you don't want to do. You make a promise in the presence of your spiritual mentor and in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, so that gives you weight and internal strength to live by what you've decided. And then also a monastic lifestyle gives you a lot more time and space. When you're king, you don't have a lot of time and space. Somebody's knocking at your door day and night. They want something. Yeah. When you have worldly power, people want something. You can even see now, you know, people try and go away on vacation and they take their smartphone with them. And technology was supposed to be able to make it so you had more vacation time. But actually it makes it so you have less vacation time because your phone's with you, so everybody's calling you, you know. So there you are on the beach in Acapulco, and somebody's saying, you know, do I sell this stock? Do I buy this? You know, the company so-and-so quit, so-and-so wants to join, what do we do? You know, on and on and on, and you're trying to get a suntan in Acapulco. And they won't let you. So this is the suffering of the lay people. As monastics, we're not going to go lie on the beach in Acapulco. We don't have that problem. They just bang on your door when you're trying to meditate. should we do this? Should we do that? Can we do this? Can we do that? Okay. So, but you know, monastic life does give you more time and space to actually engage in your practice. Unless you make yourself one of the busiest of the busy monastics, which some people do. You know, they get involved in this project and that project and the other project and, you know, on and on. I have one friend who was going to do a 3-year retreat and then she wound up working in India to get everybody their visas and taking care of everybody's visa applications and blah, blah. So, you know, you have to be careful. But, you know, as a monastic, you do stay busy. I think the guests here have realized that. And that for people who think monastics just sit around all day, I think you guys can refute that for us. Huh? So, yeah. But having the precepts, having the time, devoting your life, living in a community with other people who have the same values and practice as you do, makes it easier, you know, to keep your motivation. Of course, you don't have the pleasure of life, lay life. You can't go home to your family and be with your family and people who ideally love you and support you and everything like that. You know, instead you live in a monastery 24/7 with people who you may not even talk to if you were in lay life. Yeah. And here you are doing everything with them. Yeah. Day in and day out. And there's no place to run. Yeah. You live in a monastery, you can't run away. Well, you can try. I talked to somebody. Who was I with? With you? And we were talking to somebody who was helping to plan His Holiness's visit in Seattle. This was a few years back. And he was telling us that when he was younger, he lived at a Zen center on the East Coast. And he, one night, in the middle of the night, it was out in the countryside, the center, he left in the middle of the night and never went back. Because he was afraid to say something to the people at the monastery, so he just crept out like that. I've heard of that happening in other places as well. Yeah, haven't done that one myself. Thank goodness. okay, but it's
And there's 300 acres.
Yeah. So we have enough acreage here. You just go out and you walk in the in the forest, and then when you come back, you say, "Oh, I didn't bring my watch with me. I'm terribly sorry." As you deliberately left your watch in your room. Okay. So here in verse 401, I think Nagarjuna is assuming that the king is becoming a monastic, but we don't know. Because he says, thereupon, as a monastic, you should first become serious about your training. Yeah. He didn't say, you should first try and get really nice robes. He didn't say that. He said, you should first become serious about your training. Focusing on the pratimoksha, that means the precepts, along with the Vinaya, which is the monastic code, and also on becoming learned and determining the meaning of what you study. So let's just start with that. There's a lot in that verse. So you should first become serious about your training. What does that mean? How do you become serious? First thing is you have to have the motivation to be free of samsara. You know, have some of that motivation. If you don't want to get out of cyclic existence, If you don't want to attain full awakening, then it's going to be very difficult to be serious about your training. Yeah. So if you ordain just because, you know, you like the color of the robes and you want to sit in the front row and, you know, you think it will make you holy or give you some status or something like that, that's not going to last. That's not going to make it. Okay? So you really have to have some wish to be free of cyclic existence or a wish for full awakening. Okay. And that wish makes you serious about your training. So you see, the seriousness in the training has to come from our mind, not from somebody else pushing us. Yeah. So the guidelines in the monastery are to aid us so that we stay focused. But if we don't have that aspiration, then we're not going to see the guidelines as helping us. We're going to see them as external things imposed upon us that are saying, you can't do this and you can't do that. But I want to do this and I want to do that, and I'm an independent adult. Who do you think you are telling me I can do this and I can't do that, and what I'm supposed to do and what time to get up and what time to go to bed? You know, I'm an independent adult. Don't boss me around. I'm going to do what I want to do. So, great. There's a whole rest of the world where you can do what you want to do and you can be an independent adult. There's a whole rest of the world to do that. So go out and do it there. Yeah? That's my perspective, you know. It's like if a monastery is offering something, if you don't agree with what it's offering, don't fight it. Go and where they find, you know, where you can find what you want. There's the whole wide world, you know. Go there and, you know, do what you want. You don't need to try and change a place that's been set up for a specific purpose. Okay, so be serious about your training. And first thing, to be serious about your training, paying special attention to ethical conduct. So ethical conduct is abandoning the wish to harm anybody. Okay? So ethical conduct is not being goody-two-shoes. And it's not, you know, following a bunch of rules to the letter T so that you can be proud of yourself. It's abandoning the wish to harm. Okay? And so that's the basis of the monastic life, is training in ethical conduct that way. And the whole Vinaya, the monastic code, is geared towards helping us to do that. So in the Vinaya, we have the prohibitive precepts, which the Buddha established when people were naughty and were obnoxious and offended people. Then he established certain precepts and said, you know, my disciples, monastic disciples, are not going to do this. So you have the prohibitive precepts, and then you have the prescriptive precepts, which are guidelines that the Buddha set up about what the Sangha should do. So the Pratimoksha is the list of the prohibited precepts, at least most of them. There's some more in the Vinaya text itself, but the major ones are in the Pratimoksha. There's different classes. There's different repercussions if you transgress any of those precepts. And there's different ways of making amends if you transgress them. Okay, so you have to learn the Pratimoksha that way. You also have to learn the Vinaya in general, the Skandaka, which is another set of the Vinaya teachings, or another set in the Vinaya teachings, I should say. They talk about things that the Sangha should do. So, for example, fortnightly, we should confess any transgressions that we've made, make amends, and then recite our precepts together. in the rainy season, which has become the snowy season here, then we do the retreat, the three-month retreat. At the end of the retreat, there's another ceremony that we're to do. This one, the real doozy, this one, you invite other people to tell you what they've seen, heard, or suspected you've done wrong in those 3 months. So you're inviting people to tell you your faults, okay? And so very helpful as a way of growing. Of course, that puts a lot of burden on the people who want to speak about others' faults, because they have to learn how to do it in a nice way so that the other person can hear. Otherwise, the ceremony kind of becomes a mess. which is why you work all of that out before you do the ceremony. Okay. So there's all sorts of things that the Sangha should do that we shouldn't do. And so he's saying, you know, first thing is to learn the Vinaya and to learn it well. Know what is appropriate monastic behavior and what isn't. Now, of course, the Vinaya that we've received was created in Indian society 2,500 years ago. So we have to be a bit intelligent in the present day and age to know how to understand some of the precepts. And so that involves really looking into what are the stories in the Vinaya about what happened that made the Buddha establish this precept or that precept. Because when you learn the stories, then you see what kind of behavior and what kind of mental attitude the Buddha is directing a precept towards. Because that sometimes just the words of the precept, you can't really get what the purpose of it is. When you read the story, it becomes easier to understand. So it means you have to study, you have to think about these things, you have to look at your own behavior and you know, begin to change our behavior. Okay. So for lay followers who choose not to become ordained, then they can keep the 5 precepts, or some of them take the 8 precepts for life, and then they can live you know, in regular society, wear regular clothes, and practice as a layperson. But that's still very advantageous because they have the precepts, and that precepts help them to regulate and reflect on their actions. Okay, then that. So he said, first become serious about your training, so with your proper motivation. Focusing on the pratimoksha, that's the list of the precepts to abandon, of prohibited actions, along with the Vinaya, so all the other guidelines. And also on becoming learned, okay? So, you know, if we're going to be serious in our practice, we have to learn. It isn't just a thing of sitting down and closing our eyes and saying, I'm meditating. We have to learn what the Buddha's teachings are. Otherwise, how are we going to meditate on them? How are we going to reflect on them? So we have, you know, learning is important. But not just learning the words. That's not sufficient. That's the first step, and that already takes time and a lot of energy to do. But we have to really think about the teachings and understand them properly. And that really takes some time and perseverance. And then we need to also apply those teachings to our lives and be honest enough with ourselves to see our own faults and know which teachings to apply to them so that we can overcome those faults. Okay, and then the last line in 401 said, and determining the meaning of what you study. So it's not just learning the words, but it's learning the meaning. And it's not just learning the interpretable meaning, it's learning the definitive meaning as well. So what does emptiness mean? And it's not just learning the definitive meaning again by inference or whatever, but to really try and gain a direct perception of the nature of reality. But that's going to be a step-by-step process that takes time. Okay, then 402 says, then you should eliminate those faults that are cited in the, in the Kushtavastuka. Okay, so the Kushtavastuka is a, it's an Abhidharma style text. Usually in our tradition we follow the Treasury of Knowledge by Vasubandhu and the Compendium of Knowledge by his brother, his half-brother Asanga, and they present, they're the source of the low rig text, the mind and mental factors, mind and awareness text. And so usually we study those two, the Treasury and the Compendium. But the Kshudravastuka is an earlier Abhidharma text that Nagarjuna referred to, because he wrote this before Asanga and Vasubandhu were alive and taught. So of course he couldn't refer to their works. Okay, they were later works. Okay, so he says, eliminate those faults that are cited in the Kushtavastuka. I don't know the translation of what that means. Assiduously learn to recognize them, widely known to be 57 in number. Okay, so those of you who've been studying with Jeffrey for years, he went through these with us some years ago. Okay, so these are 57 faults that are outlined in this text. Some of them are mental factors, some of them are attitudes, some of them are actual behaviors. Yeah, so it's kind of a mixture of attitudes, behaviors, causes for bad behavior, the bad behavior itself. It's a mixture of those things, okay? But the purpose is, whenever we read any of them, to really look inside and see which ones do I have and how do they come out in my behavior. Okay, so it takes a lot of self-honesty and a lot of introspection and a good sense of humor. We have to learn to laugh at ourselves. Okay, also when we study the different texts, some of the mental factors have the same names, but the definitions are different in different texts. Don't let that confuse you. It's just how they do it. I remember when I was looking at, there's two of them, pretension and deceit, that are defined a certain way in the Compendium of Knowledge. And then I was reading the Pali version of some of the mental factors, and it was the same two names, but the meaning was reversed for the two. And they're two that are often taught together, because one is pretending you have good qualities you don't have, and the other is pretending you don't have bad qualities that you do have. Okay? But it's just those two names, you know, were reversed. So you don't get hung up in that kind of thing, but just try and listen to the meaning and check inside and say which of these things, afflict me. Okay? And then in that way, cultivate mindfulness of our precepts, mindfulness of our values, and that mental factor, introspective awareness, which checks up and sees what's going on in my mind at this time. There's one of the 57 there. Okay. So, actually, Buddha said we have 84,000 afflictions. So, this is just one version, you know. There's different versions in different texts. Okay, so verse 4 of 3 here, we're going to start with the 57. So wrath is severe mental agitation. Rancor comes from constantly having it. Concealment is hiding one's negativity. Hostility is an addiction to negativity. Okay, so let's look at these. Wrath. Yeah. So this is one that arises from anger, and it's due to having a very strong anger or animosity towards somebody, together with the desire to inflict harm on them. So it's not just being angry, it's I want to inflict harm. It's like this person is too much and I want them to have a taste of their own medicine. I want them to suffer in such a way so that they stop doing whatever they're doing that I just don't like. Okay, so you can see with wrath, there's got to have been a buildup of the anger, yeah, and a certain intensity to it, because we actually want to cause either physical harm to somebody or to hurt them emotionally, one of the two. Okay, yeah?
Would that be the same as what we call malice?
Assume
their definition.
Yeah, I think... see, a lot of these there are kind of involved with each other. So wrath here could be one of the mental factors that's present when you create the path of karma, of malice. Because malice is a path, you know, one of the paths of karma. Yeah. So a lot of these different ones, rancor also could figure into that. So they may be the mental factor that is, you know, playing into the malice, like those. Okay? So we become angry at someone or something, and then when that anger builds up and is more intense, it becomes wrath, and we want to inflict harm. So it's usually towards other sentient beings, isn't it? Once in a while, we get mad at an inanimate object. Yeah, you kick your computer, maybe. Yeah, but you know it's harder to get to have wrath towards an inanimate object. It's easier towards a human being, even though our frustration with the inanimate object may be greater because it's not working. You know, we don't attribute a motivation to an inanimate object. We don't say, that computer hates me and it's deliberately not working because it wants to drive me crazy. Okay. Whereas when a person doesn't do what we like, yeah, they don't like me and they're deliberately trying to cause me harm. So we impute that motivation on them. Interesting, isn't it? How, you know, we don't impute a motivation on a machine. We do to a human being. But in both cases, we don't know what the motivation is, actually. You know, when we impute a motivation on a human being, we don't really know if that's their motivation or not. We're just making a stab in the dark and then getting ourselves all upset about a motivation that we've imputed on them. And we've all done this, haven't we? And we've all been the person that other people have imputed motivations on. And sometimes they've imputed correct motivations, and that we'll talk about when we come to concealment. And sometimes they've imputed wrong motivations. Yeah, we'll talk about that when we come to rancor. Okay. You can see how we get really tied up in all these kinds of things. Okay, yeah?
When they use the word wrathful deity, is it the same word as this? The wrathful deity?
Yeah.
Is it the same word?
I think so. But I think when we talk about wrathful deities, I think actually fierce deities is better, because we think of, you know, like Yamantaka, we're having this very fierce appearance. And if we call it wrath, then we impute a motivation to Yamantaka. You know, Yamantaka's going to come clobber me because he's going to clobber me because I got angry. No, you know, these deities are not angry at us. They're showing force towards our afflictions. They're on our side trying to help us get rid of the afflictions. So I don't think wrath is always the best word, but that seems to be the common one. Okay, then the second of the 57 is rancor. So that is a strong sense of resentment due to habituating yourself with wrath over time. So you start out being angry, the anger gets really intense, you have wrath and you want to, you know, inflict harm, and then you habituate yourself to that wrath. Yeah, you don't say, oh dear, you know, I'm really angry, I better calm down or I'm going to hurt somebody else or I'm going to ruin my own life. You don't say that. You're not at all practical. You're off in la-la land, you know, wanting to get even. And so you have this rancor or resentment that's, you know, you're habituated to by holding wrath over a long time. And so this is similar to having a grudge. Yeah, when you have a grudge against somebody, you're really mad at them. And you're kind of waiting for the right time to get even. Yeah, you're not going to blow it by retaliating at the wrong time. You're going to really wait for the right time so you can really hurt them really well. Okay, you know that mental state? It's kind of embarrassing to admit it, yeah, but unless you have 83,999, you have it there somewhere inside you. Yeah, it may not come up too often, but the potential is there. Yeah. So it's quite interesting to really look on how we hold on to anger. And how sometimes you just hear someone's name, and just by hearing the name, you can feel the anger start to come into your body. Yeah, you just hear somebody else, you're, you know, in a whole group of people, and they start to talk about somebody else who you don't like. And they don't know that you're jealous of that person or you don't like them or you have wrath towards them. And they just talk about, they just mention that person's name and inside we're like, you know, it's like we can barely control ourselves. And then what's even worse, because that other person doesn't know that we have this whole story with the person they're talking about, is when they start talking about how wonderful that person is. Yeah. And they start praising them. Oh, they're so kind, they're so this, so generous, so blah, 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 blah. And you're sitting there like, if you only knew what that person did to me, you wouldn't talk to them like that, talk about them like that. You know? About ready to lose it. Okay? Sometimes, have you ever been jealous of somebody like that? And that comes up? Yeah? Or somebody who harmed you and then somebody's saying something nice about them? Oh! It's like, you know, they're stabbing you. Yeah, if you're, this is why we have to practice on a daily basis. Because if we practice on a daily basis and we're very familiar with other ways to look at the situation, then it's easy to change the mind at that time because we have a lot of familiarity with another way of looking at it. But if we've only heard teachings on that other way, and it's just an intellectual theory that sounds good, that we tell our friends to practice when they're angry, if it's just that, then when it happens to us, we don't even think of it. We're at a total loss. Okay, so this is why daily practice is so important. Okay. Then the third one, concealment. This is a really nice one. Concealment hides our faults and negativities from others so that they won't think we've done the destructive actions we have done. Yeah? And when others point out our misdeeds, we deny them. Okay? So, concealment functions in these two ways. One is, you know, concealment is tied up with our reputation. It's tied up with attachment to praise and dislike of blame. So somebody, we want to hide our faults. So nobody's accused us of anything. But we know we messed up and we're afraid somebody will find out. So before they can find out, we destroy the evidence, yeah? Or we do whatever it is, we establish our alibi first, you know, before anybody can make an accusation. And I'm talking like in legal terms, but this happens with our friends, yeah? We don't want somebody to know we did something because they may not respect us, you know? Or they may criticize us, or lose faith in us, or get mad at us. So we, you know, conceal it. We build up our own little story to protect ourselves and present the story before anybody could say anything. Yeah. And then even if somebody does say something, we say, I didn't do that. Why are you always accusing me of things I didn't do? Yeah, this is the pot calling the kettle black. You know, why are you noticing this in me? Because you have the same fault. Okay, so we accuse them back as a strategy to conceal our own boo-boo. Okay, so what kind of effects does this have? In your life, what effects does it have when you conceal your faults?
You lose self-respect. You lose self-respect. Because you know you've done it.
Yeah.
And you're also, now you've not only done it, but now you're also lying to your friends or your coworkers or your monastic sangha.
Yeah.
And then now it's like just, it's an icky inside feeling.
Yeah. It's a very icky inside feeling. Because we know we've done it. And then we know that we're lying to people who we really respect and like. Yeah. What other effects does the concealment have?
People don't trust us.
Yeah. When they find out that we fudged, and you know, then they don't trust us.
We don't trust ourselves either.
We don't trust ourselves. You want to describe that more?
Well, you know, if there's a habit of always trying to cover up for the fault, then you know you've made the fault. And I think then we start, it's my experience anyway, losing the compass of like, well what actually is good behavior? Or because you're fudging so much, you don't know where the lines are anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, you start to fudge, so you don't know where the lines are. And we even try and convince ourselves of the lie that we're telling.
Right.
So we may explain our actions to somebody else in one way, and we know it's not true. But the more we think about it, because we really don't want to fess up to the other person, then we start saying, well, I really did do it for that reason. That really was my motivation. And then we completely talk ourselves into believing something other than what is.
Right. But it also then leads to second guessing oneself.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Like you're trying to clean it up and you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. You're second guessing yourself. Did I do it? Did I not do it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, always wanting to even look good to ourselves. So we invent a nice excuse. Yeah.
Also, too, the whole sense of being authentic. Mm-hmm. You know, being genuine gets so compromised. You can't be at ease in your life. You're kind of, okay, what did I say to them? Oh, did I say that to them? So you've lost your spontaneity, you've lost your ease of being just who you are, mm-hmm. you know, up front, you know.
Yeah, here I am. But that response of being defensive comes like that, doesn't it? You know, and we don't think of defensiveness as concealment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, concealment sounds shady. You know? Yeah, defensiveness. Well, of course I'm defensive because they're accusing me of something. Yeah. But actually, the defensiveness and the concealment are not, they're not unrelated. They're close cousins, aren't they?
Based on something that you know you did, and defensiveness might be denying it to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So well, be overlapping but different.
Yeah. Well, except defensive, you're denying it to the other person.
Yes. Yes, you could be.
And
but you could also be concealing it from yourself and not really be, you know, like not believing you have that trait or whatever somebody's accusing you.
That's more not being in touch with yourself or not being honest. Anyway, different words, but we all know that quality, don't we?
And to what Member Sankey is saying, when you come to face, you have a public face.
You have a public face and a private face, yeah.
I think the other thing that happens sometimes is
So you're saying when we actually admit our faults to ourselves.
And don't clear it up externally, then it compounds and compounds.
Yeah.
The oscillations get thicker and thicker. And then it's like that heap of dung, like you just can't get,
yeah.
You can't dig your way out.
Yeah.
It's very dark and smelly.
Yeah, so hiding things from ourselves, it stews. And it becomes really rancid inside. And then we don't like ourselves very much. Yeah.
The despair is that there is no good in nature within. There's something that you could be a person without it.
Yeah.
You could be separate. Like yeah. Else
of course, because we're unique. Everybody else has Buddha nature, but we don't.
Yeah.
We're definitely unique.
We're special.
Yeah, we're special. Definitely special. Yeah, they were handing out Buddha nature and they skipped me in the line.
And then you have the justification to do it again.
Oh, yes. Yeah, because I'm so bad. So the only thing I can do is this bad thing. Yeah? This is, you know, in the work I do with inmates, this is the loop that some of them fall into. Very much. Yeah? I'm worthless, so just do it again, because that's what a worthless person does. Yeah. And it's so untrue.
Mm-hmm. Seems like when we're transparent, then we're more likely to address the fault and deal with it.
Yeah.
So somebody could conceal something and be working to never do it again. It seems like with concealment, it's more likely you're going to work at not doing it again or dealing with the fault or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, in our the ceremony that that the Shikshama, that the Shamaneras and Shikshamanas say, you know, the one that you recite 2 times a week, concealment, how does it go? Concealment.
Create sorrow.
Create sorrow and, yeah. But it talks, it very explicitly talks about the fault of concealment there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And harm is in there.
Hmm? We should remember that first.
Concealment brings suffering and sorrow.
Yeah, it brings suffering and...
Revealing my faults brings peace and joy.
Yes, that's it. Concealment brings sorrow and revealing my faults brings peace and joy. Yeah. And yet it's so hard to do, isn't it? Yeah.
I think doing it makes it easier. I think the fact that we do this every 2 weeks makes it easier.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you don't want to even get on the slippery slope. Mm-hmm. Or you, well, you're on it, you know, to this stuff.
Yeah.
You're on it at some level, but you just don't go there.
Yeah, it's definitely, concealment is definitely a slippery slope.
And often it doesn't, it's not effective. We don't actually hide our faults from others.
Of course not. Of course not. They know our faults.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know. Ourselves sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, that's why in the monastic community they say that we should, you know, point things out to each other. Because if we're, you know, one person's involved in concealment, of course other people know the fault. And then by pointing it out, it can help that person get out of their concealment. Okay, the fourth one is hostility. So, hostility is an addiction to negativity. Okay, so this is a stubborn liking for bad behavior, such that we are not willing to give it up, even if it harms us or other people. Okay, so hostility, this stubborn liking for bad behavior. It's kind of like the kid who's the bully in the class. Yeah? That kid gets a lot of attention by being the bully. Yeah? They do negative behavior, they get attention. So they develop this stubborn liking for bad behavior because it gets people to notice them. Or it brings them power. If you're a bully, you have a certain, you think you have a certain amount of power. Okay, it's kind of false, but you think you have that, and there's no wish to give it up.
Part of a persona.
Yeah, it's creating a persona, and again, you know, the guys that I write to who are in prison, this is one of the big masks that happen in prison. Yeah, and I'm wondering when we do watch this video, the masks you wear, if it talks about this, you know, we haven't seen it yet, but it will be interesting. To create a persona of, you know, I'm a rough, tough person, just don't come near me, don't bug me, you know, because I'm going to give it to you if you do. Okay. And then kind of feeling, I have some power that way. It's amazing how afflicted and deluded we can be, isn't it? Yeah.
It's terribly sad too. I taught 4 boys in the same gang, and there was one ringleader that everyone appeared to be terrified of. And I remember he was sick for a period because he broke his arm, so he wasn't in school. And all the other boys came to tell me how much they hated him. Mm. I thought they were tight like this, uh-huh. But they were all like, "Oh gosh, he's awful." And blah, blah, blah. But the moment he was back, I was like, "Oh, you know, very subservient."
Bravado is usually pretty empty. Okay, 404. Dissimulation is deceptiveness. Pretension, crookedness of mind. Jealousy is irritation at others' good qualities. Miserliness is fear of giving. Okay, so dissimulation is a way of deceiving others that uses deception to make others think that we care about them and want to benefit them when we don't. Okay, so this is behind people pleasing. Yeah, this is behind trying to win friends and look important and look kind. You know, we show a way to other people like we're so friendly, we care so much about them, we want to help them, but actually we don't. So it's really royal class deception, isn't it? Yeah, and it makes people think that we aren't what we're pretending to be. It'd be so interesting to apply these kinds of things to the election, wouldn't it? Yeah, between wrath and rancor, concealment and hostility in this one, okay. So often we do that, don't we? We want people to like us. We want them to think that we care about them. And we really don't. We just want them to like us so that we're popular. We want them to cooperate, or we don't want them to criticize. And so we're so nice to them. Yeah?
And this is the salesperson's MO.
Huh? It's... Say, the salesperson said, no, exactly. Yeah, yeah, I'm going to sell you this thing. You may not need it, you may not be able to afford it, but I want to benefit you because you're going to be happy if you have it. Yep.
And a politician is selling themselves. Yeah. That's the product.
Yeah.
It's like hypocrisy.
Like hypocrisy. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, hypocrisy is pretending to be something you aren't. Yeah, I think hypocrisy is maybe more pervasive. This is a particular form of hypocrisy, trying to make people think that we care about them when we don't. We do that one too, don't we? Yeah, and it's interesting sometimes how we put concealment and dissimulation together. So, we did something, somebody caught us, or we're afraid they're going to catch us. So we pretend to care about them so that they don't notice, or so that we make them think we did whatever we did for a different reason than what we really did it for. Yeah. And that way we don't get criticized, we don't, you know, our reputation doesn't go down. Okay, sixth one, pretension, crookedness of mind. So this is the one of pretending to have good qualities we don't have so that others will think well of us. So this one's very much involved with hypocrisy. Yeah. So very easy for Dharma practitioners, you know, easy for us to do these two, well, for anybody. But especially, you know, you put on a good face, you know, oh, I'm a very good teacher, I'm a very good practitioner, I'm a very good this, I'm a very good that. I know this very important Lama, I have connections to this group and that group and this teacher and that teacher. And, you know, we present ourselves as an important person and a big know-it-all, so that people will think well of us. Don't we?
I'm thinking of the traumas that I had.
Ah.
Everything is almost in here.
tell us about the training you had.
Like the sales training of how you should be relating to your clients, and how do you please them, how do you go for the weakness, kind of this, like,
oh no.
It's a manual of...
So your career training is in how to cultivate these.
How am I going to undo that?
Oh, you'll undo it.
Suffering, you'll have to leave it behind.
Yeah. Okay, then jealousy, here it says is irritation at others' good qualities. I think irritation's too weak of a word. Mm-hmm. What is a better word?
You know, despising.
Despises others' good qualities.
Unable to
say
compare.
Yeah, what it has in the description is it's the inability to bear others' good qualities or their good opportunities due to our attachment. Because we want the gifts and the services and the respect for ourselves, so we don't want them to have it. So it's not irritation, it's, yeah. You think of it?
No, I'm a bit stronger.
Yeah.
When you feel jealous and somebody's talking good about the person, you feel irritated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that's just irritated. No, you feel more than irritated. You feel, ooh.
Stewing.
So what kind of things do we get jealous of from other people? Okay, their looks. What else?
Their stuff.
Their stuff. How much they have. What else?
Status.
Huh?
Their status.
Their status.
Yes. Knowledge.
Status, knowledge, opportunities. Skills.
Money.
Opportunities. Learning.
Power.
Talent.
Financial income.
Financial income.
Their car.
Hmm?
Their car.
The car. Yeah.
Maybe not anymore.
Yes, teachers. LA.
The attention they get from others.
Yeah. Are you jealous because their cat is nicer looking than your cat?
No problem with that.
Yeah.
Or more civilized.
Or more civilized. Yeah. You teach your cat such good behavior, my cat. Okay, it isn't so many things we can get jealous of, can't we?
Just about anything.
Just about anything. I mean, person's glasses, yeah, their clothes, their anything we can get jealous of.
They're good mood, you say.
Yeah, they're good moods.
Or they can eat anything and not gain weight.
Yeah.
You could be talking about your ailments and somebody talks about theirs and they're worse and you could be jealous.
Be jealous about just about anything. It's amazing, isn't it? What a wonderful way to make ourselves miserable. Yes, that's exactly it. Because we can attribute meaning to anything. We can attribute status to anything. Yeah. I mean, when we were young, our status symbol was the more ripped up your jeans were. Yeah. The more tears you had in your jeans and the more colorful patches you used to fix them, the higher status you had. Yeah. And to our parents, it was the nicer your clothes were, the higher the status. So we can make anything into a status thing. And then, depending on who we hang out with, be jealous of other people. Okay? total inability to bear others' good qualities or opportunities. And so even what's really horrible is you see somebody creating virtue or somebody having a wonderful opportunity to learn the Dharma, and then you're so jealous. It's like, ooh, I should be rejoicing because they're creating virtue, but I can't stand it. when people, the scene around one of my teachers, you know, everybody wanted to be in his room to do puja with him. And, you know, getting so jealous of, you know, so-and-so gets to, you know, meditate and do the morning meditation in his room or in the evening. I'm never invited and I have to do this and they get to go and I don't. And, you know, oh, it's just horrible jealousy. They get to bring him tea. They get to cook for him. They get to wash his dishes. I don't. You know, anything, just how our mind can create meaning, you know, project, impute meaning out of total meaningless things.
But you have to have a trigger for that within yourself, yeah. To choose that thing, right?
Yeah, but it's always something related to my status,
yeah,
and how I feel, yeah, about myself.
Yeah.
Okay, because I can be jealous of some people. I mean, and those times I would get jealous of, like, who got to do puja with my teacher. And they were probably jealous of me because I got to lead the meditation courses. But I didn't see leading the meditation courses as a big bonus. I saw that as something that kept me from doing puja in my teacher's room. So it was a burden. And they thought, oh, but she gets to teach other people. Wow, that's wonderful, you know. And I have to try and stay awake with Rinpoche, and you know, at 4:30 in the morning. You know, so, you know, our mind can twist anything any way it wants to. Yeah? We're quite creative. Okay, then miserliness is fear of giving. Okay, so it's stinginess, it's holding tightly onto our possessions or our knowledge, out of fear of giving or sharing. Yeah? So it's a possessiveness because there's fear of giving it. Okay? So if I give away this old, decrepit t-shirt, I'm surely going to need it the next day. Even though I haven't worn it in 3 years. If I give it away, I'm going to suffer because I'm going to need it the next day. Yeah, so there's fear. I'm going to lose out.
So fear of being without.
Yeah.
What's the name of this fear?
This one's called miserliness.
Miserliness.
Yeah, or stinginess. So you think of people who hoard things, who save all sorts of stuff, can't clean out their drawers or their, you know, place. They save all sorts of, what do they call it?
Hoarding.
Pack rat. But there's
hoarding,
yeah. Hoarders. But people who are hoarders,
yeah.
Yeah, then they're actually talking about it as like a...
It's probably in the DSM.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it now the DSM?
It's part of OCD.
It's part of OCD?
Yeah,
so
it's
okay.
An anxiety disorder.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, I got to hold on to this because I might be without. And when this happens with people who have really suffered, you can understand it. But often it happens with people who are really comfortable and quite well off. But there's such fear about being without, even though they have plenty. Yeah, it's an interesting state of mind, you know, because feeling wealthy has nothing to do with how much you have. It's a total inner feeling. Nothing to do with how much you have at all. And then also being stingy about our knowledge. Yeah. I've heard of people who go to different schools. This was when before the internet, and when the class was assigned a paper to write, they would check the book with the most information out of the library and keep it so that their classmates couldn't find it. Yeah. Or it could be, you know, a teacher, even in a Dharma situation, not wanting to teach somebody something because then that person might come to know it better than they are or have a better reputation if they teach it. Yeah, so you don't want somebody to be better than you, so you don't teach them something because then they, you know, God forbid if they became better, they were more renowned than you were, they knew more than you did. So, you know, you don't teach for that reason. Really yucky stuff, but human beings do this.
One time I was a hospice nurse, the RN, I was in someone's home, and their son was interested in Buddhism or something, and he wanted to borrow, somehow or another we got to a conversation about, I guess but then it was cassette tapes, and I had somebody's teachings, and he said, I want to hear them. And I said, oh, okay. But I didn't want to give it to him because the way that he looked, I thought he was going to break it and destroy it. And he got killed the next week.
Oh,
and
wow.
I didn't give it to him before his death. So that profound. Like, I was like, oh, my God. And he already had some Buddhist teachings, which is really good. And I didn't have that.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, it's kind of, when you can give the Dharma, give it. Yeah. Okay, where are we? Okay, 405. Non-integrity is not to be ashamed of yourself. Inconsideration of others is not being embarrassed with regard to others. Haughtiness is the incapacity of honoring others. Fury is a mental disturbance caused by anger. Okay, so when we talk about the virtuous mental factors, there's two that are primarily responsible for helping us to keep good ethical conduct. Integrity and consideration for others. Integrity means that out of self-respect and a sense respecting who you are as a person and respecting your own spiritual path, then with that as a reason, then you abandon negativity. Consideration for others is with your aware of how your behavior is going to affect other people, and you care about that, and so not wanting them to lose faith in you or in the Dharma or to get wrong ideas, then you abstain from negative actions, using that as a reason. Okay? So integrity uses yourself and your own spiritual path as the reason to abandon negativity, and consideration for others uses the effect on others, that as a way to abandon. So non-integrity and inconsideration for others are the opposite of those. Okay? So non-integrity is when you don't refrain from bad behavior due to a sense of self-respect. So, you know, an example is we know the lines, you know, what consists of transgression of a precept and what doesn't. But we don't care. And so we just go and, you know, and transgress it. And we think, well, nobody else is around. Nobody knows I'm doing this. It doesn't really matter. So, you know, without having a sense of self-respect, like whether others see me or not, this is something I need to abandon. Okay? In the verse when it says, is not to be ashamed of yourself. The word shame or ashamed has different meanings. One word is shame, like, you know, know, you're shaming somebody, you're humiliating them or embarrassing them, or somebody feels shame, meaning they feel that, you know, they're inherently a bad person, something's inherently wrong with them. This is not the kind of shame that's being spoken of here. Feeling ashamed is, well, I just remember the way that I grew up with it. You know, I would hear, you should be ashamed of yourself, meaning you can do better than this. Yeah, and we know you can do better than this, and you just kind of, for whatever reason, threw this away. Yeah, so that kind of shame of, knowing that, having no sense of I can do better than this, you know, that I care about my own ethical conduct. That just, you know, whatever, I feel like doing this, I'm going to do it, who cares? As long as nobody knows, there's no problem.
That type of shame purifies yourself.
Yeah, the good kind of shame helps you to change. The bad kind of shame keeps you stuck. So we have to learn to differentiate those two. Yeah, not only verbally, but in terms of our own experience.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the negative kind of shame is really based on external judgment. Mm-hmm. And some, I know people that really suffered from that kind of thing, somebody shaming them kind of thing, and who then, not being able to differentiate it, did not have a good sense of it, of that from internal, like you talked about.
So they get criticized externally, they adapt that way of thinking about themselves internally.
Well, then they throw out any sense of having a good sense of shame for themselves, too.
Yeah.
So then they're not really monitoring their behavior in that way, mm-hmm. because they see shame as such a negative thing.
Oh, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes when people have been shamed, then they just think, oh, all shame is really bad. And no, you know, aversion to shame, and not seeing that there could be a good kind of it, meaning that we could do better.
And then they don't have a good behavior filter.
Yeah. Yeah, don't filter their behavior well. Mm. Okay, so, an example is just breaking our precepts when nobody else is around, not caring about it, and for here, for this, the great masters always remind us that the Buddha's mind is omniscient, so the Buddha knows what we're doing all the time. So we shouldn't just think, well, nobody sees and nobody knows. Okay, and so if we think like that, that helps us, not be so reckless with our behavior. And then in consideration for others is not being embarrassed with regard to others. Embarrassed is a funny kind of word, because we usually think embarrassed like, like somebody's teasing you, so you feel embarrassed. But here, what embarrassment means is other people know you, they respect you, and and so you should kind of care about how they think about you. Not in a sense of being attached to your reputation like that, but just in a sense of, I want people to regard me as an upright person. Yeah. So this one here is, in consideration of others, is not refraining from bad behavior because you don't care about the impact that it has on other people. Okay, your friends, your colleagues, your relatives, your spiritual mentors. And you don't care about the way that the behavior affects other people, and you don't care about the effect it has on them or how they view us afterwards. And so we can be totally obnoxious and just with this flippant thing of, well, who cares, you know, whatever people think of me, I'm going to be the way I am, and then just be totally obnoxious, not caring that our bad behavior disturbs other people's lives, and that in the case of a spiritual practitioner, if we behave in a very obnoxious way, it can really adversely affect people's faith in the Dharma. Of course, it shouldn't. People should not judge the Dharma by the behavior of one person. That's not correct to do. However, people do that. So knowing that they do that, then, you know, we should monitor our behavior because we care about the effect of our behavior on other people. We don't want them to think, oh, look at these Buddhists, you know. They say one thing, but look at how they act. Yeah. So something to really be careful of, especially, you know, when we go into town and we interact with different people. Yeah, and especially when you're trying to negotiate, like working with the contractor or whatever, you have to stand up for what you believe in. But you also have to, you know, you have to stand up so that the resources that are donated to the monastery are wisely used. And at the same time, you have to do it in a way so that other people don't just think, oh, these Buddhists are so stingy or so disagreeable or whatever. Yeah. But if you don't stand up and then you don't use the resources of the monastery wisely, that also creates some very bad karma. So it's a tricky situation. And thinking, you know, how does our behavior affect other people? Okay, maybe we should stop here. We're halfway through verse 405. People have any more questions? Yeah.
We have a question from an online participant. The question is, how can we create the causes and conditions to become a monastic?
How do you create the causes and conditions to become a monastic? You do regular daily meditation practice. You think about the disadvantages of the eight worldly concerns, the disadvantages of samsara. You develop the heart that really wants to be of benefit to others and to create, have a very meaningful life. And you develop that intention so strong that that's what you want to do. And, you know, other people can say this, other people can say that. People can want you to do this, people can want you to do that, but you're very clear in your mind what, how you want to live your life and what you think is most meaningful in your life. Yeah, and then of course doing purification, doing creation of merit, studying the Dharma, all of those things, and making a strong aspiration, yeah? Having that strong aspiration, and not dreaming up excuses for yourself. Yeah. If you find that you're dreaming up excuses for yourself, then maybe you really need to step back.
Can you explain dreaming up?
Excuses for yourself. Let's see. Oh, there's so many ways to do it. Yeah. It's like, well, I can't get ordained because you know, my parents put me through school and they spent so much money on my education. I really want to ordain, but I just feel so badly because they put me through school with such sacrifice that how can I just do that to them and get ordained without, you know, working at the career that they schooled me to do. Yeah. Sounds good, doesn't it? Sounds like a good reason. Oh yeah, I've got to take care of them in their old age, you know, for sure. Nobody else can. Yeah. Yeah, there's no other siblings, there's no other resources in the world, there's no people who want a job doing that, yeah, so I have to be available for that. And I won't look good with my head shaved. Yeah? It's like when I was a kid, I banged my head, so there's like something swollen here. If I shave my head, everybody sees it. You know, I can practice just as well as a lay person. I've heard that excuse. You know, oh, there's so many. I mean, you know what all of them are, don't you?
I haven't lived life to the fullest. What if I ordain and find out that this isn't really the right thing, that I should have done this and I should have done that? Yeah. I haven't lived my life enough to renunciate.
Right, I'm too young. I need to have more experience. What happens if I, you know, sign up to be a monastic now and then I change my mind later because I decide I really want to go to Disneyland and it's on my bucket list and I just can't give it up.
Yeah. What I do really helps people, and I'll be such a bad nun. I should better do what I'm doing now.
Yeah, because what at my career really does help people.
Yeah.
And it does. Yeah. And my parents will flip out and have a heart attack. Mm. Yeah, that one I've heard plenty of. I'll wait until my parents die, then I'll ordain. That one I've heard many times. You know, because if I do it now, they'll get sick, they'll have a heart attack.
I actually have more freedom to practice if I control my own life.
Yes.
More flexibility, I can go to teachings when I want, I can spend hours meditating on the weekend.
Yes.
Yeah, you guys work too hard.
Yeah, if I live in a community, I always have to do this, do that, cook, wash the dishes, you know. If I'm a lay person, I just have to do things my own way. Much more freedom. Yeah, somebody wrote us about that one too. Yeah, much more opportunity practicing Dharma at his job than at the monastery. That was an interesting email. Yeah.
What if I ordained and the monastery closed down?
That one I haven't heard yet. What if I ordain and the monastery closed down? That's a good one. I haven't thought of that one, but yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
But they say getting married and have children is the best place to practice the Dharma.
Oh yes, this one's a real good one. Yeah, getting married, you have to sacrifice yourself to get married and have a relationship. And children, then you really have to practice bodhicitta because you can't let your baby cry. You really have to get over your own self-centeredness.
Yeah. Well, you can introduce them to the Dharma early as children.
Yes, you're
giving
them a precious human life. They can. You can introduce them to the Dharma early. They'll be monastics. Except you don't want them to be monastics because you want grandbabies. Yeah. So that's another one. But my parents want grandbabies. You know, I've got to give them grandkids. Otherwise, they're going to be so disappointed. Okay, so not dreaming up excuses like that. that don't seem like you're an excuse. When you're in the middle of it, this seems like a perfectly reasonable reason. And because it's for the benefit of others. Perfectly reasonable.
Yeah. There's lots of good nuns, but I don't like that one nun. Hmm? Like, if there's a lot of nuns, but there's one that you don't like, then you don't want to ordain there because you don't like her.
Yeah, right.
So you're looking for the perfect place where it's like,
yes. Yes, I want the perfect place where I love everybody and where they all appreciate me. And when I want to ordain in a monastery where I can climb the ranks in the monastery. Yeah. We've encountered that one too. Yeah. Uh-huh. Somebody asking. Yeah. Asking
questions.
Was there career? You know? Yeah. So you think the Yeah, people open some other branch monasteries, and some of the, you know, the monastics will get sent out to run those other branch monasteries.
Senior compost toilet turner.
Yeah, me and